seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Right, okay. This is how you win a golf tournament. You lead by five on Friday after shooting a 60. Then you shoot 68 on Saturday and you follow that up with a 65 on Sunday. Now, by any measurable standard, that is the formula for victory. And it lead. Wait, no, hang on. No, he lost by three. Siwoo Kim just played some great stuff and still lost to Wyndham Clark by three shots, who shot his own 60 on Saturday. Lads, John Huggan, Dave McIntyre, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I mean, so that was the story of the CJ Cup. Byron Nelson played on a golf course outside Dallas. 30 under. Dave, I'm going to read a text you. It's like, lads, it felt like I don't want to spend over an hour talking about the CJ Cup, Byron Nelson.
Yeah. Look, I don't mind these sorts of events on these sorts of golf courses every so often. It is the sort of run-of-the-mill PGA Tour event where someone shoots between 22 and 30 under par and walks away with a pretty sizable check. And we kind of just dust our hands of it. That's all that we'll say about it. And we move on to whatever the next event is. There aren't as many, it feels anyway, there aren't as many of those sorts of events on the PGA Tour regular season events as there used to be, where it's just target golf and whoever can just get the putter going is a really good chance of shooting crazy low. There seemed to be a big crowd at it. There seemed to be a buzz around the golf course. I know they've spent a lot of money on trying to upgrade the golf course. They've put up millions and millions of dollars in trying to pro-proof it. Clearly that hasn't worked. But for the event itself, as a one-off, and a couple of big names on the leaderboard, a couple of major champions, a guy ending a two-year drought, albeit probably not the most popular winner of a tour event of all time. It could have been worse, but I certainly won't be looking forward to next year's CJ Cup.
No. We'll talk about Wyndham Clark in a minute. I just want to talk about Siwoo Kim just briefly. Like, okay, so he shot the 68 on a fairly kind of receptive course on Saturday, so it felt like he left a handful of shots out there, but six birdies in his first 12 holes on Sunday. And Clark just kind of came out of it. Like, how do you, like, it's very hard to countenance 11 under to win. To Dave's point, John, the crowds were big. It felt like the excitement was there. But watching it on TV, it just felt, I don't know, it felt flat or something to me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to come across as too snobby at this point, but this is kind of an extreme example of the dumbing down that we've seen at the pro level. I mean, the things that they have to do to golf courses now to keep the scores within what used to be deemed a respectable range. I mean, the recent PGA was a perfect example of the kind of things you have to pull, the tricks you have to pull to keep the scores, around about the 10 under par winning range. What they need to, the first thing that I would do is change the pars. I mean, it's 30 under par. You just said won the tournament. There is no such thing now as a par five on the PGA Tour. Very, very rarely. So just make them all par fours. You make the par 67 or 68 or whatever, and suddenly the scores begin to look, you know, a little bit more sensible than 30 under. But it's just it's not for me. It's a driving and a putting contest, nothing more. There is no nuance, no subtlety, no real interest. As I say, if you hit the ball, if you drive it 300 and odd yards, which, you know, just about everybody does now, you're hitting wedges in. And if you're the guy with a hot putter that week, you're going to win.
Yeah, which Wyndham Clark most certainly had. He made 450 feet worth of putts on the week, and a third of those came on the Sunday alone. Like, he was draining them from all over the place.
Yeah, he's that kind of player. I mean, he's the kind of archetypal modern tour pro, in that you don't hear from him for fairly long periods, and then he suddenly pops up. He gets hot, wins a couple of tournaments. It wouldn't surprise me if he wins again fairly soon. He's that kind of player. He's a really streaky. And it's, we've said this before, but it's all about at the top level now. It's all about hitting home runs. Nobody wants to be the consistent guy. Consistency is the most overrated quality almost now for top tour pros. You really just want to go out there and get hot 4 or 5 times a year, and if you get hot in the right week, you might even win a major.
Dave kicked off like he clearly showed his intent on the second, rolled in a 23-foot birdie, then had three straight birdies from 4 to 6. He drove the green on the, I'm seeing it here, describes as the short par 4, 14th. Stress-free birdie. Then he had 45 feet on the par 3, 15th. That was when he took the lead by himself for the first time. Like with the amount of putts he was making, you could build like a 6-bedroom house on that acreage.
Yeah, look, in fairness to me, he was the one draining the long range putts and doing it more so frequently than any other player in the field. Like, he had a fairly average front nine. He only went out in 32, which is shocking, really. comes back in 28. Like, it's just ridiculous scoring. I think there's very few players have managed to put a score together like that. I think he's, I was just reading, he's the 10th man to finish a 4-round tournament at 30 under or better since 83. So only 10 people have done it in 43 years. That sort of thing has the potential to be spectacular. And when you're draining long putts like that to go and win a tournament, look, there is something eye-catching about it, obviously. He does tend to win big tournaments generally. He's obviously won a US Open and had to grind that one down. So he's won in different ways where the stakes are higher than they were at the weekend. I guess they felt pretty high for him because he hadn't won in a couple of years, but he's won around Pebble Beach as well. He has, unfortunately for him, has kind of made more headlines off the course than he has on it over the last couple of years. So I'd say he's delighted for any number of reasons to be talked about because he's back at the winner's circle as opposed to smashing up lockers at Oakmont or.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, John, I mean, redecorating the lockers at Oakmont, and I think to Dave's point, it felt unsatisfactory, his apology or his explanation or the way it was dealt with just felt as if, like, spoiled pro does spoiled pro things and let's all move on because whatever the next story in the news cycle is. And that's kind of lingered a bit. It's a bit like Matt Kuchar and not paying the caddy in Mexico. It's just like he's, look, in fairness, sorry, not in fairness to Wyndham Clark, in that the Matt Kuchar situation was so obviously avoidable. Whereas, I mean, sorry, I'm not saying that he couldn't avoid beating up the locker in Oakmont, but one is the source of extreme frustration, the other is just like miserliness. But both are examples of bad behavior that linger and really impact the public's perception of you as a sports person.
Yeah, that's it. What surprised me most about the Wyndham Clark thing at Oakmont was not that something like that happened, but that we heard about it.
Yeah, true.
You hear about it in the media, certainly. I mean, behind the scenes, I could tell you two or three incidents, pretty similar incidents like that with players. One particular on the European Tour. He plays on the European Tour now. He did it as an amateur. I mean, he completely trashed a hotel room in Prestwick. And was informed, please don't come back to the host tournament, the course that week. He was told, please don't come back. So these things do happen. But yeah, I mean, Wyndham Clark's clearly a bad-tempered so-and-so, and that's maybe part of his charm, if you like. I mean, that sort of thing kept in check can be quite entertaining. It's just when it tips over the edge. I mean, you get that. You talk about the spoiled tour pro. I mean, I'm sad to say that my compatriot Bob McIntyre didn't distinguish himself at the Masters. I mean, he behaved pretty badly, and so did Sergio. But Sergio at least had the semi-decency to come out and apologise 2 or 3 days later. We're still waiting for McIntyre to apologise for anything he did at Augusta.
Is the actually it's an interesting distraction. Now I could have missed it, but was the behavior that you're talking about, is he literally gave the finger to the river or to whatever it is, the Rae's Creek? Like, in my mind, I mean, I've heard anecdotally that Bob McIntyre does have, like, he does have a bit of a temper on him, like, and he can get very frustrated and express that frustration. But like, Flipping the bird to Rae's Creek, is that really, or is it just because it's the hallowed halls of Augusta and we have to treat it like it's sacred ground? Or, is that the same as Sergio's
Well,
behavior?
no, it wasn't as bad. I mean, Sergio, I thought, behaved worse, but
Yes.
at
Well,
least he
which of the
apologized.
John, which of the 48 examples of Sergio's behavior are we talking about?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, I think the worst one was the expectoration into the cup.
Oh, that was manky.
Yeah, I mean, really? Come on, it's.
It's also what you're doing is like you're giving you're giving a proverbial fuck you to every player who's going to be picking a ball out of the cup thereafter.
Yeah.
Like that's manky behavior.
I mean, he's definitely, no matter where the line is, he's crossed it a few times.
Absolutely.
More than a few times. But I mean, but this is becoming a trend with McIntyre. I mean, this was just the latest kind of thing. I mean, the swearing is, I'm not really too upset about that. That's the least offensive of the things that go on. But it's becoming a pattern, and I know, behind the scenes, I've been told by more than one player that it's almost reaching the stage where, nobody wants to play with him. It's
Wow.
becoming a distraction to the other player, which I think is almost like rule number one that you must not do, is do something that impacts on the ability of the other player to perform. And that's what I'm hearing. It's maybe, maybe exaggerated, but I've heard it from more than one source. And it's not a trend I would like to see continue because he's obviously a hell of a player.
I like I've made no secret of the fact that I'm a huge, huge admirer of Tyrrell Hatton as a golfer. I like him very much. I enjoy his passion. I like the way he expresses himself. It makes me laugh. However, a good friend of mine who knows his golf is absolutely convinced that that inability to control his temper or to moderate his mood is the thing that's impeding him from true greatness or from winning a major, from really kind of being able to deliver on what is undoubtedly a phenomenal talent.
But you don't want them all to be behaving like Patrick Cantlay, though, do you? Like, we don't want 156 automatons out there to
No.
deliver nothing for us. The fact that we have the Bob McIntyre, Shane Lowry's, Tyrrell Hatton's out there, even Sergio's and Bryson's, who just bring something different, even though if at times it's a bit distasteful. Like the lad who just hides underneath the peak of the baseball cap and is so dialed in and everything's so measured and controlled. Like even Scotty shows emotion from time to time, gets angry with journalists afterwards. That's what I want. I can't be listening to the same old trite that players
No.
across all sorts of sports churn out now to journalists pro post and pre-matches or rounds or whatever the circumstances may be. I love watching Tyrrell Hatton because you don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah,
He's
I'm
like,
the same.
The clip of him where he hits a really poor shot and he turns around to his caddy and says, "Have you ever seen a worse shot than that?" And the caddy obviously just doesn't say anything. No, seriously, answer the question. Have you ever seen a worse shot than that? I love that. And that's harmless. That's a victimless crime as opposed to spitting into a cup or behaving the way McIntyre does to the point where it's going to interfere with your playing partner.
You mentioned Scottie Scheffler. So Scottie Scheffler, again, another sneaky good performance. Finish what? Tied third. 25 under. So 10 tournaments now without a victory for Scheffler. He started 2 rounds off or 2 strokes off Kim's lead. Just kind of, he played well. What was he, 6 under on Sunday? Played well without like taking. I thought some of his wedges early doors were a little, probably given his extraordinarily high standards for his approach play, he'll be disappointed with some of his wedge play. But look, shot 6 under, 25 under, again, like metronomic almost in his brilliance, but just not able to convert that into wins.
Yeah, I think when the winning score is as low as we've just been talking about, I think that's when the best player, whether it's Scheffler or anyone else, is at their most vulnerable, because it is just a putting contest, and putting, as we know, is a not something that Scheffler is particularly known for. He's improved a lot, but it's still not the strength of his game, if you like. But then 25 under, again, even if we take into account that there are no par fives, it's still pretty good golf. But he's at, he's, as you say, he's going through a stage where He's always the best player every time he turns up, and it takes somebody playing at the top of their game to beat the best player, typically. It just seems to be a phase where Scheffler is finding people at the top of their game almost every week at the moment. I mean, but he's still the one right there. I mean, if most weeks, not every week, but most weeks, if you beat Scotty Scheffler, you probably win the tournament, and that
Yeah.
hasn't changed.
No, absolutely not. Dave, finally, green shoots of recovery for one Brooks Koepka, 18 under. So he gained more than 2.5 strokes in the field with the putter. So obviously, the putter has been his demon stick for the last 2 years or more. Now, he had a tough day of it on Friday. It rebounded then on Saturday and over the weekend. But do you see anything this is a guy, he's trying to play his way into the signature events. He also made, it was an interesting, for a guy who really leans into that kind of alpha jock persona, he was almost emotional when he talked about falling back in love with the game.
Yeah, I sometimes I wonder when he was ever really in love with the game. He used to talk about regular tour events with an almost a level of a disdain, and that showed in his results in those events. Like, he's won more majors than he has PGA Tour events, and obviously he's a serial major winner, and you'd be foolish to bet against him picking off another PGA Championship or US Open before the end of his career. We remember the scenes from Full Swing where he was clearly emotional when he was scratching around in the dirt for his game, and then he decided to just cash it all in and leg it anyway. So I'm not sure how much that showed that he was deeply in love with the game. Buyer's remorse set in pretty quickly. Clearly wasn't loving things on LIV either. Bails out on that and comes back to a PGA Tour career where he's not in the signature events. And if you had said back in those days when he was barely showing up emotionally from regular tour events, if you said to him, you know what, in 6 years' time, you're actually going to have to treat these with a level of importance just to play in the bigger tournaments, he would have been absolutely horrified. And yet, this is where he is. And I just wonder where he is in his head in terms, like, he should be well able to go and win at the bloody CJ Cup. Do you know what I mean? But he was really, yeah, I know he was 18 under and he's in a tie for 14, but he was never anywhere near being remotely in contention.
No.
The putter got a little better this week, but I'm sure an awful lot of players left the golf course on Sunday night thinking, I may have played my way into a little bit of form on the greens, but let's see how you rock up over the next couple of weeks when everything's that much harder.
I think Koepka is he's an extreme example of something that isn't that uncommon at the top level of, I'm imagining any sport, but certainly true of golfers in my experience, is that he may not love the game, as we say, but he loves the competition. And he loves to win, and I think that's where he gets his satisfaction from. Certainly winning majors at the top level, and probably the his attitude towards your regular tour events is probably just a symptom of what we're talking about. Is that he, the competition isn't the same. The winning doesn't mean as much, so therefore his intensity goes down. I mean, I just think that he's a guy. He's the ultimate competitor. But it needs the ultimate competition to bring that out in him, and I think that's what we see in him.
I take your point about him. When did he ever love the game, Dave? I mean, I guess when he played in Europe, back in the old days when he was showing up to the DP World Tour, and there was something about him. But I agree. I think there's a bit of a road to him. He doesn't look like a major winner, does he? Really?
Certainly not now.
No.
And obviously, his game has gone a bit from his time on LIV. He has kind of flirted with being on the fringes of contention in majors over the last 18 months without ever actually getting himself into the piece. You would think it will come back, but he's not playing well enough in these events to get him into the signature events if he even treats them as the sort of level of competition that is really going to get his competitive juices flowing. Obviously, he's going to be in all of the majors for the foreseeable, given the exemptions that he has. But he has to try and find some form to really perform in them. Another major win, and obviously the doors will open to every other tournament that he wants to play in. But he's intriguing, and he always has been. And there is a better feel to any tournament where Brooks Koepka is on the leaderboard, but he has lost all of that aura that he had, that big dog, alpha male, physically molding or demolishing golf courses, bending them to his will, particularly on, say, a US Open style golf course where the guys around him are just almost cowering because he is strutting the fairways. But so he's a million miles from that at the moment. And until he sort of regains that, he's going to find it very hard to put the foot down on a Sunday in a major championship.
Mm. Yeah, I think in Kepka's slight defence, I've got him penciled in more for next year than this
year. Right.
He's rebuilding, isn't he?
I think so. I think we're being a little bit, you could argue that we're being slightly premature in judging him in the comeback to the PGA Tour and proper golf, if you like. Mm. I think he needs some time. And I think I'll be very surprised. As I say, I've got him penciled in for 2027 to win something big.
That's, you know, I like to hear that. That's nice. One guy I wouldn't imagine you've penciled in to win anything big this year or next year is Jordan Spieth, who, oh, what can we say? Second round 62, and all of a sudden you're like, dare we believe? Dare we? Dare we? Dare we? Five bogeys across an 8-hole stretch on Saturday. Like, on a course that, honest to God, is just giving up birdies for fun. Now, he did have a 66 in the final round, but again, it's just like a guy, the inconsistent. And I realized that Spieth was always, always a mercurial golfer who was capable of doing extraordinary things following some incredibly poor shots. I was watching something, I think the algorithm on Instagram showed me young Jordan Spieth, like a 16-year-old who was getting up and down from like Seve-like positions, you know, mad drives, mad seconds, and then, but like, top 25 finishes in 14 starts, which is not terrible, but still can't bag a top 10.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you touched on it there a little bit. Even when Spieth was pretty much the best player in the world and winning majors at a fair clip as he did, it always struck me that the one doubt I had about the whole thing was that, is this a sustainable formula, the way he plays? It relied, you know, an awful lot on the holing of 20-foot putts, two or three 20-foot putts for pars every day. And he was doing that for a while. I mean, he was a bit like Luke Donald when Luke Donald got to number one. I mean, Luke Donald was number one in the world with a formula that was terrific, but was not sustainable. It basically, you know, it was based on the holding just about every putt he looked at because he didn't have the length to compete elsewhere. And Spieth was, you know, it's kind of the same thing. And now the difference between Spieth then and Spieth now is that he doesn't make those 20 footers with the same regularity. He does occasionally, he maybe does it 3 days out of four, but he's certainly not doing it 4 days, and he's certainly not going to win tournaments. And the winning of the, or the completion of the Grand Slam in his case seems a fairly distant prospect.
Yeah, for sure.
Right now. But you never know. Golf's a funny game. I mean, he could just have the week of his life at the right time and do it. I wouldn't bet on that, but it's not impossible. Given the character of the man and the way he's, I mean, he's used to playing like that. I mean, some people panic when they're hitting bad shots, the bad shots that he hits, but he's used to that. He does that pretty much every day, and it's not going to faze him, the actual hitting of the shots, but it's the results that will be getting him down. I mean, it's a process, obviously.
I've told the story before, I think, but at Glen Eagles at the Ryder Cup, which is, how long ago was that now?
2014.
That's what, 12 years ago. So this is before Spieth. I think Spieth had won on the PGA Tour, but he hadn't quite gone on that run of just brilliance that catapulted him to the top of the world rankings. But remember, he played McDowell in the singles and he went up early. And then McDowell just clawed him back, you know, just one hole after hole. And I was there with a friend and he was following that match and he was standing next to Jordan Spieth's mother. And she turned around to whoever she was with and just, as Jordan was getting more and more annoyed and frustrated, and he was like, oh, Jordan doing Jordan things. Like, that's clearly, you know, that ability to be brilliant, but also to be a little bit fragile and also frustrated and very expressive and emotive and all the rest of it. That thing that makes people love Jordan Spieth, like, it was there, has been there right from the outset.
Yeah, you're right about the Ryder Cup. If you look at his record in the Ryder Cup, I mean, his singles record is really poor.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Now, there's two ways of looking at this, of course. The way that Spieth plays is, you could argue that it's actually made for match play because the opponent never quite knows what's coming next. But on the other hand, the way Spieth plays gives the opponent a lot of encouragement. There's a lot of bad shots in there, and every bad shot makes the next shot for the opponent that bit easier. And I think that's where he suffers, and certainly in match play, is it, it's an inexplicably bad record in the Ryder Cup. I mean, he's really been poor.
Lads, I want to ask you about just the state of play within the PGA and just what the CJ Cup represented. But before we do, just a little kind of shout out to Blades Brown, who turned 19 on Thursday and needed to finish in solo 21st place or better to get his special temporary membership on the PGA. Finished on 18 under, tied 14th, made it with plenty to spare. So, there's a possibility of a budding new star on the horizon, Blades Brown. I always think of it's like a name that's perfectly suited to golf, but
Old style golf, at least.
oh, well, certainly old style golf. Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. I presume, Dave, he warmed the cockles of your heart, old Blades Brown.
Yeah, I'm sure he's probably already known as BB to his mates. He has a look to him and he has a way about him that is refreshing. And you would hope that he, now that he, maybe the little bit of the pressure is off him now, having achieved what he set out to do at the weekend, that he can actually really start to relax into what is obviously the most early steps of what he will hope will be a very long career. But anyone new who's coming onto the scene like that, that is just a little bit different. I'm always up for just exploring how that develops in the years to come. Although I, alternative universe, we'll never hear from him again. And in 3 or 4 years' time, people will be like, do you remember that Blades Brown guy? Whatever the hell happened to him?
Yeah, he took all the money he earned on the PGA Tour and then just went away, because they'll all make a ton of money. I want to ask you about, so Dave, you said it, so the course had gotten this renovation, $25 million. It feels like, and the crowds were good, but as a TV spectacle, it just looked really, I just thought it was bad TV product. Can I just say, just on an aside, so I came home from, I was in Florida for the last week, which is why I wasn't around to do the recap of the PGA Championship last week. And what struck me, because I was away for both the end of the PGA Championship or all of it, and also the beginning of the CJ Cup, was how underwhelming it is as a visual experience in the daytime. Like, so I'm in sports bars, and obviously the basketball playoffs are a big deal. That's happening. That's taking over. There's some baseball. The season is kind of pottering along. But particularly with the PGA, I thought a major championship, particularly in Florida, which is golf mad, that it'd be a much bigger deal, and it wasn't. It was a casual sporting afterthought as a TV event. In terms of like when you walk into a bar, is it on the TVs on behind the bar? No, it wasn't. And absolutely on Thursday and Friday, it wasn't either. The CJ Cup wasn't on at all. You had to go and seek it out. And it seems to me that, like, I mean, obviously that's an ongoing problem, but like when I got home and I sat down and was watching it on Saturday and then Sunday, I was like going, okay, but this is kind of shit to watch. I'm sorry, I know it sounds dramatic, but like it just wasn't that interesting, despite the fact that these guys were shooting low numbers. Like, sorry, I know I keep going, but it's just like the course feels too easy despite the renovation. It just felt there was no strategy involved. What we'd seen the week before, which demanded strategy and accuracy and putting a premium on approach, this just felt just hit it hard, hit it long, get it on, make putts and go home.
Yeah, you make a good point, but I mean, I lived in the States. I mean, it's been 30 years ago now, and obviously saw the golf on television week to week. And it's golf has never been, the PGA Tour has never sold itself to television on the basis of the numbers. Golf is very much a niche sport. It's sold on the basis of the demographics, which are very high end. People with a lot of disposable income tend to watch the golf. So going to sports bars is not the place to watch golf normally, or get to see a lot of people watching golf. That's never been the case. It's certainly not in my experience. You need to, you do what I did. You tape it and zap through all the commercials and watch it later, which is what I did every week.
Yeah.
But it's but you're right. I mean, my one of my criticisms of the PGA Tour is that the sameness that you mentioned, that the challenge, the questions asked are pretty much the same every week. The fairways tend to be the same width. The rough's the same length. The greens are the same speed. And it's, there's just the same every week, or too many weeks. It's not the same every week. That would be an exaggeration, but there's definitely some need for some variety. And as you touched on with the winning scores, I don't think we need 30 under every week, or even numbers approaching that. The PGA, again, on the other side of the coin, though, they have to trick the golf course up to make the I mean, that wasn't the true Aronimink that we watched in the PGA a couple of weeks ago. I mean, for the first tip off is always, if you look at the aerial shots, all the bunkers were in the rough. So the course, the design of the course has been compromised
Yeah.
right off the bat, and they do that because the ball goes too far. And if the ball went, everything would be better if the ball didn't go as far at that level. It would certainly be a far more interesting product to watch. I mean, if you take Aronimink, the fairways would have been wider, the balls would have been rolling into the bunkers instead of flying into them. That was the only way in. The rough wouldn't need to be quite as thick. The greens wouldn't need to be quite as fast, those particularly severe greens, and the pin positions could be a bit more sensible as well. And what we got at Aronimink a lot of the time was everybody hitting it to 30 feet and two putting. That was why the field was so compressed. I mean, it's a fine balance, and I know it's not something that you can get right every week, but they don't seem to get it right any week at the
No.
moment. And the root cause, I mean, I keep banging on, and I'm the old fuddy-duddy in the corner who keeps saying this, but the ball goes too far, and everything bad in professional golf at that level stems from that.
You briefly mentioned something there as well, Fionn, that I think probably is a little underrated and under-talked about, that the Americans have to watch the PGA Tour in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
And it's something that we kind of have a major advantage in this part of the world, because we get to sit down and watch golf on a Saturday night or a Sunday night when we've got everything done that we need doing. Like, imagine trying to sit down and watch a proper tour event on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon when you're either doing something yourself, or the kids have matches, or have training, or you're sitting down for dinner, or you're visiting whoever it is. It's very hard to do that guilt-free. Unless you're of a certain demographic and you're retired, maybe, and your Sundays are spent watching TV. And obviously, it's competing with a whole host of other sports. There'd be nobody watching golf in this country if it was up against the Premier League and the hurling and football championships.
Absolutely.
We
That's
get to sit
absolutely
down
true.
and watch it
Yeah.
on a Sunday night, and it's great. And the only question is, how late can I stay up because I have to get up for work tomorrow? But if you're in Florida and it's beautifully sunny outside, you're going to sit down and watch the final round of the CJ Cup at 2 in the afternoon?
No.
Absolutely not.
And yet, so like the old model, the PGA Tour, use like a bit of a traveling circus where they go from one city to the next, and like that's all gone. It's now in the new media landscape, and it's like it's designed to increase TV ratings. The broadcasts are designed to be compelling. The fields, they want them to be as strong as possible. They want dramatic course setups. This is what the PGA Tour say. And to me, and I'm sorry, I'm not picking on the CJ Cup just exclusively, but a lot of PGA Tour events seem to kind of laugh in the face of that logic by going, like, you're on the one hand, you're going, okay, really good crowds just outside Dallas. There was clearly some good sponsor support. The local enthusiasm was really there. You could see it, like people were into it, but like you're watching it on television. And to me, the setup of the course, the almost negligible jeopardy made for an incredibly boring television spectacle. And I mean, I look, smarter guys than me are befuddled by the conundrum, but I just don't see how an event like the CJ Cup is going to improve the product. I just don't. And
I
that's not to
think
disrespect Wyndham Clark or Siwoo Kim or any of the players that performed well, but
you'd have to ask the tour what their target audience is going forward. I mean, everyone talks about growing the game. Now, to grow the game, you're going to have to bring new people in, and you're going to have inevitably a lot of those people are not going to have a great understanding of the game because they're new to it. And the people like that are going to be far more attractive, or most of them, to guys just blasting the ball miles off the tee. I mean, there is an attraction to that. I mean, it's fun to watch, even for old cynical old buggers like me. But it's that's. It's again, it's a balancing act. I mean, how far do you dumb the thing down to attract a new audience and get them interested? I mean, long drives are sexy. There's no getting away from that. But I'm not sure that if I'm standing behind a tee, I can tell a huge difference between a 340-yard drive and a 280-yard drive.
I
You
certainly
think
can't
that's a
tell the
very
difference
good
on
point.
TV.
No,
I
no.
think that's absolutely spot on. Do you know what? You've actually just something that I've never verbalized it really, but you're absolutely right. Like Shot Tracer is, because they show the arc or whatever, and Rory cutting corners is incredible. But like, honest to God, 340 yards or 298, like on TV, there's no difference. You're like, okay, you hit the ball a long way. Well done.
Yeah, well, I think we need to get back to that, and then the game can then has the opportunity to become, the what I would refer to as more interesting. I mean, the ball needs to go shorter and it needs to go sideways more, I would argue. I mean, I use this line all the time, and you've probably heard me say it before because I've said it many times. But if nobody is playing golf like Seve or Lee Trevino, how can it possibly be better?
That's a good point. That's a very, very good point. Right. I think Dave, you've had your wish. We've done 37 minutes on the CJ Cup. I want to talk about a couple of other news stories. LIV Golf is, well, they're looking for $250 million investment, who and Scott O'Neill, the CEO, has projected profitability within 2 years. Now, I struggle to see how that's going to work. Like, particularly if you're going to scale it down dramatically. And we'll talk about Bryson DeChambeau in a second, but like you're not going to attract the big stars. You're going to be an entirely different kind of model. Like, if you don't have a huge amount of money to attract the Brysons or the John Rahms or the whoevers, they're not coming. So you're gonna, like, how is this going to make money?
Well, I suppose there's two ways of getting to profitability or increasing profitability, reducing expenditure and increasing revenues. And that number of $250 million is minuscule in comparison to what the PIF had to pour into LIV Golf over the last 4 years. And yes, if they're not offering John Rahm $150, $200 million to join, they're going to save themselves an absolute fortune. Of course they are. And they can probably get something close to breaking even, but without having to pay all these stars to come and play. But what sort of a product have you got? Where's 250 million going to go? Because there's no way the revenues are going to increase by massive sponsors getting involved or major TV deals. They may go down the social media slash YouTube route. But who's going to watch videos on YouTube that don't have superstar golfers doing things that superstars do? Rahm is the only chip they have. And I'd say John Rahm is suffering many sleepless nights at the moment because he seems to be the only one of the stars that are still on LIV that has no way out at the moment, no escape route. And the way he spoke about LIV a couple of weeks ago, talking about how watertight his contract was, and they don't seem to have given him an out at all. If it is a massively scaled down LIV Golf event with about 10 sort of exhibition events next season, and he's forced to play in them, that is so grim. I mean, he must regret the day he sold out on all his principles and decided to take the money, sorry, decided to help with the growth of the game. And with the money that they're talking there, O'Neill and the 250 million, well, like what could LIV Golf possibly look like in that set of circumstances in 12 to 18 months' time when there's no big names on it, nobody's watching, and yeah, you may be saving yourself a fortune, but what is the product?
When I talked to Paul McGinley, in Carton a few weeks ago, he was making the point that, like, to host a signature event on the PGA Tour costs 40 million because you have 20 million in prize funds and then 20 million in ancillary costs. So that 250 million, you know, there you go. That's five events plus change, really. Like, it's an unsustainable model. And also the other point that was made, which I thought was quite interesting, is that a lot, the Live was making a big deal about the success of its events in Australia and South Africa. But again, as Paul was pointing out, is that, yeah, you have all these crowds, but you're not charging them anywhere near the kind of money you need to charge as an entrance fee to wash your face. You're operating at a loss, even though you've got big crowds. Like, so it all, that's all smoke and mirrors. None of that is sustainable, even with the success of the events in South Africa and Australia. You're still, there's still a money loss. So it just, I mean, yeah.
It just
mean,
looks like they're trying to kick the can down the road here.
Yeah.
And or, to what end? Like, what is the, what's the big picture play here? Like, the money men are gone.
That's it.
If you are someone of wealth and you are being asked to stump up a portion of this $250 million, what are you investing in?
Yeah.
And these guys don't make their money without it being fairly sure there's going to be a return on their investment. That's so exactly where do they see the gains being? When he says we're going to be profitable within 2 years, how? Built on what? Based on what? Driven by what? Like, who are these invisible people who are going to be thrown $50 million at a scaled down Live tour that doesn't have any superstars on it and nobody watching?
And also where the prize funds are reduced from whatever it is, the astronomical amounts that they have now, to like a fraction of that, to, you know, a couple of million maybe, to, you know, per event, where the winner might pick up a check for 600 grand, you know? It's like, it, that feels, you know, where the prize funds are comparable to the kind of prize funds on a middling DP World Tour event, not like a top World Tour event, yeah. DP World Tour.
On the plus side, I was on the phone this very morning with someone who's heavily involved in Live and has seen it from the inside. And he was saying that the cost savings of right off the top would be huge.
In terms of what? Like on saving on...
Just the amount of money that's been spent on, you know, business class fares for caddies was one thing that he mentioned. You know, that would, you know, it's maybe all small numbers compared with what we're talking about, but they could make huge savings on the cost front, scaling everything down. But as you say, the barricade or the wall that I keep hitting with Liv is that what format is going to be attractive to first sponsors, then the public, then even television. I mean, I struggle to come up with something, because I think if they were ahead of me on that, they would have come up with it by now, because what they've had, we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years, it doesn't work outside of, you know, Australia and South Africa. I mean, you watch the, you know, regular tournaments on Live, which I rarely do, but I tune in just to see what's going on, and there are not many people watching on the ground. And as you say, that's one of the pluses of the PGA Tour, and one of the things that the PGA Tour has to be careful of, I think, going forward, is that a lot of the tournaments have got long-standing histories, and they're in what would be defined as smaller markets within America, but they've got huge local interest because it's the big thing. Excuse me. I mean, I lived in Connecticut, which is, you know, again, not too far from Boston or New York, so it's maybe not the best example, but the biggest sporting event actually in Connecticut every year was the what is now the Travelers Championship, the week after the US Open. Actually, inside Connecticut, that was a huge deal. Mm-hmm. And I used to go for one day because that was enough, because the traffic and the crowds were just unbearable. And it's, you know, so the PGA Tour, if they go to the model that we've touched on, you know, the big events, fewer big events in bigger markets, that's the kind of thing that they might lose. And they've got to be careful, I think.
Yeah, I think, I mean, again, and it's all speculation, of course, but like, obviously they're going to have to go with smaller purses and maybe even fewer events if they really want to, if Scott O'Neill thinks that this is the way to profitability. Is an alternative like more exhibition style golf? Like, I mean, its detractors have often criticized or dismissed LIV as like Harlem Globetrotter stuff. But like, you could theoretically lean into that a lot more and make it as like, you know, where all of a sudden, like, instead of playing standard golf, they could be doing exhibitions or tests of great skill and trick shottery. And I mean, you know, that's a model they could follow. Or like, worse things going worse, and I'm not a business person, but like, you know, they could declare bankruptcy and then restructure completely, you know?
Yeah, yeah,
are they trying to rebrand themselves and relocate themselves in terms of their hub, their base, to the US to put them in a position where they can take advantage of maybe more lax, easy to move around bankruptcy laws? What happens to the likes of Ram if that occurs? So, obviously, he can walk away then, but he's a creditor and he may want his money, but they'll have it. There'll be a queue around the block looking for their share of whatever's left.
Well, that's why.
Plus, we focused probably quite rightly on the, you know, the Ram DeChambeau, you know, the top end of the LIV players. But the, if you take a step down and you get to the Joachim Niemanns and, you know, maybe even Tyrrell Hatton, he's slightly better than that. But those sort of guys, I mean, the implications of the wider implications of all this, I mean, the European Tour, I've got decisions to make. I mean, if you were a hard-nosed businessman and you were looking at the European Tour, you looked at the Joachim Niemanns of this world and you thought, well, are these guys going to make our products better week to week? Because one of the big problems on the European Tour is the fact that it's just so tedious and that there's nobody there, that no names are playing really every week. It's the really second rate, if you want to be harsh about it. The Joachim Niemanns of this world would enhance the European Tour greatly. I mean, they should be falling over themselves to get these guys back on tour. However, the other side of it, of course, is the European Tour is a members' organisation. The rank and file are not going to be too keen to see the return, you know, without any kind of punishment, probably, of the Joachim Niemanns. And, you know, turkeys don't vote for Christmas, as they say. So it's a real dilemma for the European Tour. I mean, I'm not sure which way they're going to go. I mean, I would vote for, you know, getting these guys out there as soon as possible, because the second rate product, which I've maybe harshly, you know, described it as, they need help, huge help. I mean, there's huge areas of the European Tour that are, you know, it's like tumbleweed. There'll be a wee burst, you know, round about the Open. The Scottish Open's a big event, obviously, but again, it's on the PGA Tour as well. So, and then at the end of the year, that's when it kicks off, really. You get a run of really top class events, but even then the leading Americans don't come. That's another thing that needs to be looked at if I'm the European Tour. Do you want the top Americans in there? Do you make them, you know, co-sanctioned just to get those guys to some of the at least some of those guys to come, that more like Billy Horschel, who's done in the past? But you don't see Scotty Scheffler. I mean, I'm tired of talking about Scotty Scheffler and his inability to go anywhere in the world outside America other than the Scottish Open and the Open every year, and every 4 years a Ryder Cup. I mean, I really think that he's got a responsibility to the game that goes beyond just money. I mean, get yourself out there. Just one week a year, just go and do it.
It's true. I don't disagree. Meanwhile, while all this is going on, Bryson is musing about, yeah, maybe I'll just stick to my YouTube channels. And you're like, whichever, for the love of God.
I mean, this is a man who didn't think that they went to the moon. So, you know, come on.
Oh, yeah, good point. Oh, Bryson, the scientist. sweet God.
I've talked to proper scientists, by the way, about some of the stuff that he comes out with. Absolute nonsense. It's total gibberish.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, is that surprising? I don't think so.
No, probably not.
No. Okay. The last bit of news I wanted to ask you about was, the US Ryder Cup Committee announced that Keegan Bradley was going to be an assistant captain.
So laughable. His record in the Ryder Cup obviously speaks for itself. Played twice, lost both times. Terrible captaincy on home soil. where he got the course set up totally wrong, said some very stupid things over the course of the week, most notably when Air Force One is flying over the golf course and how the fortunes are going to change because the president has just flown over, all that sort of bullshit. And so who does Jim Furyk turn to when he wants like an inspirational figure alongside him as a VC? He goes for Keegan Bradley. Why is Keegan Bradley even being considered for a vice captaincy? Another strand to it is he was almost, he would have been on the team last year had he not been the captain. Like, he surely would have got a pick from the captain had he not been the guy administering the picks. And 2 years out, well, not 2 years out, 18 months out, he's got himself on that, in that situation again. Like, is he going to bail on the vice captaincy if he's a potential player? He probably will. It'd be easier to do so. But I don't know why they keep going back to these guys. Like,
yeah, it's so weird, isn't it? I mean, the sort of program in place in Europe is that they have a bunch of vice captains. Now, not every vice captain has gone on to be a captain in Europe, but they pick guys who they think, oh, he's got a chance. Let's see how he works out. He's a possible captain for the future. And some of them have gone on. They've been vice captains first, and then they become captains. The Americans do it exactly the opposite. They pick their vice captains on the basis of failed captains from the past. I mean, it's exactly the opposite of what they should be doing. It's weird. And I don't get it. I mean, as you say, Keegan Bradley, I mean, goodness me. I mean, the number of things that he got wrong, I mean, quite apart from the fact that he kind of let the game down by not speaking out far more on the behaviour of the crowd at a time when it would have help the, you know, the both teams. I mean, I don't think the Americans were particularly helped by the behaviour of the crowd any more than the Europeans were. But you touched on it a little bit there. The number of things that this guy got wrong as captain, and now he's back. It's exactly the opposite. He should have been one and done and out the door.
Absolutely. He's being rewarded for failure. Right. Well, this week it's the Charles Schwab at Colonial. Pretty decent field, I have to say. Keegan Bradley's in the field, amongst others. Anyway, look, we will regroup next week to discuss as we await the next major. As always, Dave, a pleasure. John, thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
We've got Shane Ryan coming up with the Ryan Line on Thursday with Nathan. So if you have a question, you can just submit those via the Discord channel, or you can email golfweekly@offtheball.com. Lads, have a good week. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.
All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here. Starter kid right here.